Today, we'll talk Minecraft, Nintendo NX, email privacy, and Facebook's killer quarter. All that and a whole lot more on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1501, recorded Wednesday, April 27th, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Igloo Software. Igloo is an intranet you'll actually like. It connects people with the information they need to do their best work. Try it free at igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action.
And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now to take advantage of their Mother's Day limited time sale through May 3rd only and enter promo code TNT for a free color upgrade.
Oh, hi there.
Oh, hello.
This is Tech News Today, the show where we talk about technology news with people who love technology.
Yeah.
I am Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. And I feel like we're off to a great start because with the very first words of this show, we got Kara to laugh.
Yes.
Go us.
That's my goal.
Welcoming back to the show. As always, always such a great show when we get Becky Worley on the line. How's it going, Becky?
Great to be with you guys. I'm blowing everyone's mind because I'm not in my kitchen. I'm what? In my living room.
What? I didn't even know this was possible, Becky.
I know. So, you know, just as your minds or ears or eyes are just subjected to new experiences, just go with it.
Just go with the flow.
I feel like you're making a feminist statement by not being in your kitchen.
I don't have to be in my kitchen. Mm-hmm. I can relax on the couch. I can bring home the bacon and not have to fry it up in the pan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it.
Well, let's get to some tech news. You can now play Minecraft on your Gear VR virtual reality headset. The pocket edition of the game that every nine-year-old in the world is addicted to can now be downloaded for $6.99 from the Oculus Store. Now, I think we all have some thoughts on Minecraft and virtual reality for the kids. Becky, you go first.
Well, I think I'm going to continue this theory of blowing your minds because I'm generally not super pro VR and I'm not really pro Minecraft, but I actually see this pairing as making some sense. People who love Minecraft, they say that it feels like a free new world where anything can be done, sky's the limit. So if you can create an even more realistic environment because you're using virtual reality, I think it can make sense. I mean, I thought that the HoloLens demonstration of Minecraft at E3 was incredible to see multiple dimensions of these worlds you're creating. In a way, that does make sense to me. What do you guys think? Do you see your Megan, you have older kids than Jason and I do. Do you see your kids getting sucked into a vortex from which they'll never come back?
Yes.
Next story.
To put it quite simply, yes. They're already in that vortex, which is the interesting thing about virtual reality. I mean, I was talking to Gregory Panos. He's an old pioneer in virtual reality. He's been studying this stuff since the 70s. You know, and I asked him this question, like, what do you worry about the isolation of it? And he said, you know, Megan, we're already there. We're already looking at our smartphones all the time. Like, we're already isolating ourselves in virtual reality. There's a whole world where we can be with other people. So I think that goes along with what you're saying a little bit. I don't know. We had a discussion about virtual reality for kids. Jason and I did. And like, I still have worries and no one knows what it does to the developing brain. No one knows if it's good or bad. Mm-hmm. So I have worries about that too. Of course. So this is the pocket edition is just for smartphones and, you know, the Gear VR, you have to have a Samsung phone. So it's, but I mean, my kids play pocket edition and they play on the PC, or on the Mac, and it's a lot of the same features at this point, but I think the HoloLens will be more interesting than this.
Yeah, for sure. That's going to be kind of the more augmented, delivery of it, like, you know, the demos that we've seen kind of placed on a table or whatever, looking into it, seeing it stack up. This is more like a first person builder or instead of a first person shooter sort of thing. I think it sounds interesting. It supports cross platform play. So if your kids are already playing the Pocket Edition or whatever, this is going to tap into, you know, the mobile versions, be it VR or not. Kind of seems like to a certain degree, Minecraft is maybe one of those kind of killer apps for VR, because not only is Minecraft just a super big success among a very kind of targeted specific demographic, but VR just kind of seems tailor-made for this kind of experience. So,
You would think the demographic of Minecraft would be 12, 13-year-old boys exclusively, but some reports put the average age at 28. And so, you know, lest you think that I'm completely bullish on both of these things, I see this as a great use of virtual reality. And I also completely agree with you, Megan, that, you know, there's no reason to necessarily create more immersive environments for our kids to go into. And, you know, I've talked about this quite extensively with Leo, that I'm like crazy Waldorf mom about how I won't let my kids use gadgets in a lot of that toy way. They can use them as tools, but, you know, they don't play Minecraft. And so I'm only because I just feel like I'm concerned about how much time and energy they would go into. And I don't think they have a good off button. As I always like to say, it feels like handing your kid a bottle of tequila. Now I think you're giving them like some sort of a funnel if you put it with VR.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, you're completely...
Or heroin. I don't know.
Okay. Not very friendly on the VR front today, okay? There's something to that, right? Like, I can remember as a kid sitting in my bedroom, you know, on the summers, playing my Commodore 64 and just getting lost in it. But I was still connected to the outside world. I could still see the room around me and see that it was sunny outside and eventually decide, okay, hey, maybe I should go outside and actually run around a little bit, be a kid outside instead of just inside playing games. When you're in VR, I mean, that's pretty much it. You're isolated and locked away. There is a little bit of the social component, though. You know, this is all network play, so they can see their friends in the virtual world. So it's not completely isolated in that front. But yeah, I feel like this is always the question, though, is how can we get our kids out and away from this technology that's rotting their brain? And I don't know if it's necessarily rotting their brain, but it's easy for me to get concerned about it as a parent.
It's like ice cream. I mean, everything in moderation, you know. I mean, the only thing I dislike about Minecraft is the time, you know, like you're saying, and how they feel afterwards. It's the same thing about ice cream. Like, you can't just eat ice cream forever. You'll feel bad. You can't Minecraft.
We've all tried.
But it is interactive. I mean, my kids have friends over. They all play together. You know, it's an interesting game. But I think getting it on VR is sort of like, you know, Max in the classroom. Like getting these headsets on kids so that they will spend a lifetime with that technology. I think that it's a good move.
I will be getting a Samsung Gear VR very soon, because it was part of the Samsung Galaxy S7. If you pre-ordered, then they'll give you one. And I think sometime in June, I'm supposed to receive one. Will I let my kids check out VR? I mean, they're pretty young. They're 3 and 6 at this point. I don't know. I feel like that's just opening a can of worms at that young of an age. So I think I might wait and just hoard it for myself.
And the point you make, Jason, is that you don't know. Nobody else knows. I mean, I remember doing a story a few years ago about the thousands of apps on the App Store that, you know, claimed that they would make your kids smarter, help them read. Well, those are all great claims, and the things that technology can do for your kids. Sure, there are lots of options, but we really don't know, to Megan's point, what the effect of things like virtual reality or screens or games are, because there aren't as many longitudinal studies as you would really need to know conclusively. So you kind of have to go by gut. And when it comes to parenting, there are a million ways to parent, and all of them can work. But this is just another added facet that parents are going to have to go, will we or won't we?
Right. Yep. Well, speaking of games, Nintendo earnings were today, and it was full of meh. First, earnings fell 60% year over year, a dramatic drop. It really kind of highlights its third place position behind the Sony PS4 and the Xbox One. Investors were hoping for some positive news for this year on Nintendo's upcoming platform, the Nintendo NX console we've heard a little bit about here and there. Instead, Nintendo revealed the next-gen console won't release until March of next year, 2017. There will be no preview of the device at E3 in June. And it was announced that the much-awaited Legend of Zelda game that was expected this year for the Wii U is being pushed to 2017. Possible speculation that it might actually be held off for the NX release. So not a very good time, not a very good day for Nintendo right now. And it really kind of seems like the only thing they have really going for them, at least lately, is this kind of mobile push, which they've only just begun. Miitomo is the mobile app that they released, I don't know, not very long ago. Right now, they're earning about $280,000 a week from in-app purchases on that. And they have plans, or reports say that anyways. Nintendo didn't say that. And they have plans to release a couple more games for mobile by the end of the year. So it could be a good kind of way to slow down this bad situation, because that is not very good.
Yeah, you said it was a mess set of reports. I would say it was an oh no set of reports. I mean, yeah. The numbers here are really dismal. If you look at overall console sales, back in 2008, they were nearing 100 million units. And then you go fast forward to 2015, it's almost half that at 50 million units. And the numbers are even, that's all consoles, not just Nintendo, obviously. And Nintendo is one of the smaller ones there. But then when you actually look at Nintendo console sales, you know, they had a huge hit with the Wii. And then the Wii U sold maybe a third or a quarter of as many units as the Wii did. So it's just really gone downhill all the way around, both the market and for Nintendo.
I'm interested in what the NX will be. I mean, it might be virtual reality. It might be like a hybrid between a mobile and a console game. I mean, I don't understand why Nintendo won't release their regular games on mobile. Why not? It's just they're taking a stand against mobile?
They've always kind of held that position. I mean, the fact that they even have any sort of mobile presence right now was a pretty big turn for the company. One of those when pigs fly. Oh, wait, pigs are flying suddenly. Like their plans for the remainder of this year is to release a game tied to their role-playing franchise, Fire Emblem, which is pretty popular, and then Animal Crossing for mobile. But yeah, you kind of look at their whole landscape of obvious, you know, big name releases, things like Legend of Zelda, you know, Super Mario, all those kind of legacy characters and games that are tied to those that pretty much drive, for so many people, are the reason that anyone gets their console to begin with, are those kind of premium titles that are produced by Nintendo itself. Why not on mobile? My kind of response to that on a personal level, though, is that when you make money in mobile gaming, you make it primarily these days because of in-app purchases and that whole thing. And I just don't know if I want to play a Nintendo game that's filled with in-app purchases. Like, I would guess that it probably would be in order for them to make that kind of money.
Well,
it worth it.
Look at the Minecraft model, and Pocket Edition costs $7 and mm-hmm. people buy it. And you know, it's the gateway drug to the real edition. And, you know, and it does a lot. And it's, mm-hmm. and I mean, kids play and adults play both versions, and it works. There's no ads, there's no in-app purchases. Everybody's happy.
Yeah, no, I agree. That would be awesome. But, you know, right out of the gate, Nintendo's Miitomo, you know, in-app purchases, and they're getting a taste of that. And I don't know, it taps into the whole in-app purchase thing, taps into this kind of primal like thing in people that people just have a hard time resisting that. And as far as development is concerned, that's hard to resist, because you know it's literally, you know, we're talking about, I can't remember if it was pre-show or during the show, we're talking about that like mainline heroin thing. I think it was just online. Like, that's literally what that is for some people.
We've
compared video games
to drugs and alcohol.
I'm really sorry. I'm sure we're going to get a couple of emails about that. Anyways.
It is only the addicts that speak with such certainty. And I would have to say that there are certain games for which, like with my kids, do what I say, not what I do. Mommy, who's given herself like RSI from playing Plants vs. Zombies.
Exactly.
All right. Well, Engadget says that Amazon is liable for the unauthorized in-app purchases. Speaking of in-app purchases, made by kids. A federal judge sided with the FTC against Amazon, claiming the company did not do enough to protect the consumer in this case. Judges made the same ruling in cases against Google and Apple. When its app store launched, Amazon required no passwords on purchases from the app store. Then they changed the limit to $20, and then they extended the time limit wherein kids could make purchases. That was 15 minutes after the password was entered. Now, we don't know the amount of monetary relief that customers will get. But in the case of Apple and Google, it was over $50 million that was paid out to consumers.
Guys, this is such a cool metric for how far behind Apple Amazon is. That was January of 2014 when that went down around the Apple App Store and passwords. And it's taken 2 years, almost 2.5, for Amazon to catch up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think a lot of people even know that you can buy apps through Amazon. Like, that's not a common thing that if you people
have
do.
Yeah, if you have the Amazon tablet, I mean, it's yeah, how you do it.
That's true.
You know what I mean? If I won't say the Amazon phone because we know how that went. The Fire Phone was not a success, so I doubt many people have that at all. But yeah, if you've bought any of their Amazon Fire tablets, that's just how you get content. Like, there is no Play Store on there. You get content through Amazon's App Store, and that's just the way it is. I always feel like in this, and I think where we are now as a result of this, so I'm grateful of that, but security should be the default. Like, in, you know, and all these stories are kind of tying together in a very interesting way. But, you know, as far as kind of like in-app purchases are concerned, for the longest time, the reason people were making gobs and gobs of money was, you know, at least to some degree, because it was so easy to fire off a payment and there was no, password prompted when that happened, when making an in-app purchase. So a kid just has a tablet and they're playing and suddenly they're presented with this ability to get 500 gems. All you have to do is tap this button. Boom. I don't know why there was no password tied to it in the very beginning. And I hope that the kind of default going forward for all of these things is password all the time, unless you tell me not to. And, you know, it seemed to be the opposite way, and that's just wrong.
That makes a really good parallel as you're thinking about what you're talking about is frictionless purchases. And it makes me think about both the pin and chip, which is so popular in Europe. And now we've got the chip here in the US, which is ridiculous because we have no pin that goes with it. So there's no actual two-factor authentication for purchases. Totally. And we're also seeing a really big slowdown in chip adoption because it takes so much longer for purchases when you actually use the chip. And, you know, you ask yourself, why would the credit card companies allow us to not protect our purchases, you know, with a pin or force merchants to use the chip card? Well, it's because they are benefited by these frictionless purchases too. So it's not just in apps, it's in the physical world as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, no doubt all these companies benefited from, you know, kids just buying gems and their parents not knowing, you know, it's 99 cents here, 99 cents there. You never look at your credit card statement. You know, they were benefiting from it. These were games for kids, games designed for kids. And
There's still a layer of responsibility on the parent as
absolutely.
Well, though, right there, right?
Yes.
Like it's one thing. And I think a lot of people without kids, let's say, are probably yelling at the podcast right now saying, well, you know, the parents are the ones that gave them the tablet or the device, you know, in the first place. And they should watch, you know, what their kids are doing and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, I don't know. I think when there's the ability to build in protections against this stuff, then that should be done. And that's what these kind of lawsuits have done. So, yes, responsibility for the parents, but also it's very nice to have the protections in place as well, because then everybody's protected. I mean, that's the point. So
the Apple 15-minute window to, make a purchase, and then within 15 minutes, if you're going to do anything else, you have to enter the password again. Mm-hmm. It's just such great common sense protection, and it really works. So you'd like to see that become industry standard.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I see that on Google Play as well. You can kind of, the first time you set up a Google Play on a new device and you install any sort of an app or make a purchase, it asks you, do you want to enter the password? Do you want to be prompted for the password every 30 minutes? After you do it, or do you want it every single time? Just go with every single time. You know, it's not a big deal.
There's a new multi-generational issue that comes around here. Maybe this is only endemic to tech reporters who sort of have lots of legacy gadgets, because I have passed those on to my parents and they're all preset with my account. So I'm just like, oh yeah, it's fine, whatever. And then I get the bill and I'm like, Mom, Dad, what are you buying?
You're the sandwich generation of in-app purchases.
I'm getting hosed from both sides.
All right, so I don't think this next story has anything to do with the last three. We were able to get a nice little weave going, and now we're going to break apart entirely and go to space. SpaceX announced today that it's planning to send its own Red Dragon spacecraft to Mars in 2018. If it's successful, it would be the first time a private company has actually landed a vehicle on another planet, not to mention the first commercial vehicle to land on Mars. The craft is usually used for sending cargo to the International Space Station. In this case, it would land in Mars in much the same way as the Falcon 9 rocket that it landed a few weeks back. We talked about it on the show, on a platform in the middle of the ocean, which is just super cool to see. Yeah, it's a pretty lofty goal. Not that I don't buy that SpaceX can pull this off in a couple of years, basically, but it's super ambitious. I mean, basically, all they've done at this point is announce that they are going to do it. They still have to build and test the Falcon Heavy. Falcon Heavy is the rocket that's going to push the payload into space, and they have to figure out how they land on Mars with this, because basically, Earth's atmosphere is a lot heavier. It slows down the returning spacecraft, so it makes for an easier landing. There's a little bit more resistance there. Mars' atmosphere is 1/100th the pressure of Earth, so it doesn't necessarily slow things down as much. So when you're talking about landing this huge, you know, super heavy cargo with, you know, whatever they plan on sending over there. I mean, NASA's struggling with this right now to figure out how they land, one metric ton of hardware, and SpaceX is planning on doing more. So they've got a lot to figure out in a couple of years. But Mars, we're going to Mars.
I'll just take the space elevator.
Okay. Personally. All the way to Mars?
Yeah. Well, and Elon Musk says that's not physically possible. It's Science says space elevators won't work.
Yeah, I know. They've been talking about space elevators would. For years.
But yeah, NASA's helping them out. It's not sure, you know, it's unclear, like, the exact relationship. But I do love that they have a relationship now. Like, I love that we're able to fund this sort of space exploration through independent companies. Yeah, like it's SpaceX.
Crazy. I mean, SpaceX, I think it was last year, they released posters, and like old school style posters of colonizing Mars. So, you know, SpaceX, Elon Musk, they've got plans. They want to get people on Mars at some point. I don't know if this happens in our lifetime necessarily, like space tourism to Mars. Kind of doubt it. But hey, you never know. This could be one of those things where you clip this out and then 40 years later, play it for me when I'm on my deathbed, and I'll be like, oh, I remember when I thought that. Boy, was I wrong.
The thing about SpaceX, though, it's like he's really interested in science and furthering science and working with NASA, where like Jeff Bezos, it's like, that's really space tourism. Like, you know, this is interesting. And you got to hand it to him. Like, half of the missions to Mars have ended in failure. And so we've seen it on Twitter. Like, we've seen him, like, crash that rocket and then, you know, buy another one. You know, so I think he can do it. Yeah, he's got money and chutzpah.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think that for the last, you know, maybe 7 years ago, for about 5 years, it felt like every space story we were doing was this sad woe is me tale for all the space fans, like space exploration is dying and it's all going away. And then to your point, Megan, capitalism and bringing that spirit of adventure sort of from people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos into it has really reignited the excitement around that. Plus, added benefit, we get names like Falcon Heavy.
Falcon
you wouldn't get
Heavy.
That name out of NASA.
It's true, it's true.
No, it's great. And, you know, all the ships that they've landed on are all like science books of, you know, science fiction titles. And so.
I think what we need to do to further invigorate people is we need a crowdsourced naming of the next rocket.
Rocket McRocket Face.
Yeah, Rocket McRocket Face. There we go.
I love it.
All right.
Well, moving on, it is a rare day that we get to report positive privacy news. So let's take a second to just enjoy the fact that the House of Representatives has passed the Email Privacy Act. That's H.R. 699. Let's take a second.
Yeah, just breathe it in.
Enjoy. The bill is an update to the Electronics Communications Privacy Act from 1986, and it upholds the Fourth Amendment, which requires the government to get a warrant before accessing emails in the cloud. So this is good news. They've been trying for a long time. It has passed the House. Next moves on to the Senate. Now that we've taken a moment to appreciate it, we'll tell you that the EFF says it's not perfect. The law doesn't require the government to notify us when they're checking our emails in the cloud. But we do get, they have to have a warrant now.
Okay.
Which is good.
despite the fact that it seemed like everyone was in favor of this, which is a clear sign that if it has that much bipartisan support, that it's a no-brainer. Despite that fact, this was actually a little bit confusing to understand because it kind of was a legacy issue that wasn't really being used as much as you might think. But basically, the difference is in the past, they could do this with a subpoena. Now they have to get a warrant. The difference being a subpoena compels you or the service provider in this instance to do the work of providing all the information. Whereas now with a warrant, all they really have to do is open the door. And it's also a higher standard of justifying the warrant. But it is kind of, I liked what Paul Ryan said about it, that the last time this law was looked at, he was flipping burgers at McDonald's. So, why is when I was flipping burgers at McDonald's or that in general such a metric for people? And B, how often do I agree with Paul Ryan?
Good point. Well, that is the fascinating thing about privacy. Like, it does not fall down on the regular sides of politics that we're really used to. Which is really interesting to me. But you bring up a good point between the difference between a warrant and a subpoena. I mean, you could sort of draw the parallel to the Apple case. I mean, because, you know, the government was making Apple give them the information. Of course, there's not a, it's not a direct parallel because they couldn't. That was the thing. Like, you can't just say, like, open the door because the door is locked and they didn't have the key to it. So, but.
All I can think about, and it has nothing to do with this story.
Is it hamburgers?
Is that I saw the trailer for Snowden, the new Oliver Stone, Edward Snowden film earlier today, and it looks really bad. So this story kind of brings me down. It's a bummer, man.
Yeah. Well, after the break, we will talk Facebook earnings and the future of streaming video on the platform with Alex Kantrowitz from BuzzFeed. But first, let's take a minute to thank Igloo, the sponsor of this episode. Igloo is an intranet that you will actually like. It's a cloud platform that helps you share files, collaborate on documents, blog updates, coordinate calendars, and manage your biggest projects. Anyone can add content based on their permissions with drag and drop widgets and a WYSIWYG editor. Igloo also offers a variety of access, authentication, and identity services to ensure that only authorized users have access in private clouds over SSL and with 256-bit encryption. Unlike other solutions, you can customize Igloo to fit your needs and work with your current IT investments like Office 365, Salesforce, SharePoint, Active Directory, and file sharing solutions like Google Drive and Dropbox. You can even add Zendesk to keep track of or add new support tickets. It's used by large enterprises and growing companies like User Testing, BDO, American Family Insurance, and ATP World Tour. Try it free at igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action. And when you sign up through our link, you get your own Igloo for up to 10 people absolutely free for as long as you want. That's igloosoftware.com/TWIT, and we thank them for their support.
All right, so it hasn't been a great week for public tech company earnings reports, unless, of course, you are Facebook. Joining us to talk about Facebook's monster quarter is Alex Kantrowitz from BuzzFeed. How's it going, Alex?
It's going well. Thanks for having me, Jason.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So Facebook reported net income of $1.51 billion for the quarter. That's triple the $512 million it earned last year for the same quarter. What is Facebook doing right that its competitors apparently are not?
Well, I think the truth of the matter is Facebook's just bigger than all of its competitors. I mean, look what happened with Twitter. You saw that they missed their revenue expectations. And it's a time where user growth has really caught up with Twitter. So, advertisers are looking at these social media companies. Like, Twitter knows well that it's in the social media bucket. And so advertisers are looking at these social media companies in the bucket and saying, which can do the most for our money? And all these companies are having a hard time coming up against Twitter. I mean, the company is growing pretty spectacularly still, which is amazing. And how much more could the company grow? That's what I ask myself after each earnings report, and yet it continues to grow. It's at 1.65 billion monthly active users right now. So how do you compete with that if you're a smaller social network? It's hard to say.
I mean, as far as growth is concerned, I mean, at what point does Facebook hit the wall? Like you say, it's kind of crazy to think about those numbers and just the sheer, amount that they're tripling, per year is just insane. So obviously, Facebook's, you know, mobile first strategy is working. 79% of its revenue tied to mobile advertising specifically. What does Facebook have to be worried about at this point, or is it just kind of all roses?
Well, I think the original sharing thing is something that Facebook needs to pay attention to closely. Might not kill its business, but it's definitely an issue. And it came up today during analyst Q&A, and Mark Zuckerberg gave a pretty interesting answer. He said sharing is up across the platform. Time on the platform is up basically on all of its products. But he didn't say original sharing is up. Mm-hmm. And when original sharing is the stuff that when you and I would post our text or a photo or a video, as opposed to, let's say, just hitting the share button on something that a media company has posted or a meme that we see. And as that stuff declines, Facebook is going to become less vibrant. You're going to see less of those heartfelt statuses. You're going to see less of those goofy photos that you once saw and more of this starch professional content. So Facebook doesn't want this to be the case. It wants original sharing to go back up. And so as that continues to decline, it's something that bears watching.
So was he making the case that original sharing isn't the future of Facebook? Because I know that live streaming, and you wrote a piece about, you know, how all the platforms are doing this. They're paying some celebrities or just some people to live stream on their platform. Is that what he's saying? That maybe like social networks will be more traditional content where it's a person that we admire sharing their content and not our grandma?
I think he very much wants original sharing to go back up on the platform. And he actually referenced that when he was talking about live stream, last question on the call. And Ellis said, hey, what's up with the live stream? And then Zuckerberg says, we need to give people tools to express themselves and to share more. And that's like a thing that people want to do. And we just need to provide them the tools. And that to me indicates that he wants to see more original sharing on the platform. But then if that's the case, the way that Facebook's going about this is pretty crazy. Because alongside this desire to bring more raw and visceral content, which is the way Zuckerberg describes it, into the platform, they're also making the live API available to studios. And this past weekend, they'd streamed their first professional sports game. So I would say, which one do you want, Facebook? Do you want more original sharing? Do you want to bring down the barrier that a lot of people feel they need to meet in order to post on the platform? And if that's the case, then scrap the API that gives broadcast quality video a chance to work on, through the live streaming.
Alex, Becky Worley here. I think you've nailed it in terms of your point that he's hedging his bets. I think there's the great hope that this generation will be able to create original content in video because they have the tools. But maybe I'm just a wizened or a gnarled old video producer. And no, it's not just about the tools. Is that creating compelling video is a real skill set that needs to be developed and nurtured over time. And I think you just completely encapsulated the fact that they don't know whether original content can or cannot sustain that engagement level that they want out of video. What do you see as the prognosis for the more commercial and studio-driven content to take dominance?
I think it's likely. I mean, if you've ever gone live, I mean, even right now, it's so difficult. It's really, really hard. And I've gone live on my personal account a few times. And I have to say, even when I do it through BuzzFeed's accounts, I struggle with it. I'm not naturally good at this stuff, and I make content for a living. So I think that if Facebook thinks that everybody out there is going to see that they can go live and just do it, they're betting on something that's unlikely to happen. On the other hand, what you mentioned, professional video sources, there are people that create professional content for a living. Yeah, I would bet that they would jump on this as they have already. So we could see more of that and probably not as much of the original stuff as Facebook hopes.
You know, one other thing I noticed on the call is that an analyst asked Sheryl Sandberg about how they're reaching out to small and medium-sized businesses, and she was really pushing how advertising on Facebook is such a great platform, and it's really sort of budget-friendly for those SMBs, small and medium businesses. But then when you think about video ads and the cost of production for an effective video ad, it doesn't really matter how much it costs to run it on Facebook, which is something like $4 per 1,000 views. Actually creating a video campaign that an advertiser could use is cost prohibitive only to the largest of companies, right?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, we're definitely seeing easier tools to create video, but it's still, as I mentioned, incredibly difficult to do this. And so you're right. Where are these mom and pop shops going to get the quality video that they're going to run on the platform? I don't see it happening. I mean, I started my career as an ad buyer. And one of the things that we did was we were running print ads. And then we thought, well, maybe we'll do digital ads. And so we tried out Facebook. And it was enough of the battle to say, let's move print ads to digital. I can't even imagine what the looks I would get if I said, hey, you know those digital ads? I need $10,000 to make a video that we can put on Facebook. I mean, $10,000 is my entire media budget. So where do you come up with the cash?
You just hold up your phone and you go, hey, guys.
That's going to sell it, Jason.
Well, no, maybe what Mark Zuckerberg is banking on is that there's going to be so many people lowering the barrier for live video that it's going to change our expectations. I don't know.
Hang on. Let me just say, okay. If he's going to, I know you're about to transition.
It's okay.
But if he's going to do that, then why is he giving these live capabilities to studios and showing soccer games through the live product? If he thinks that people want to share more, then it makes no sense to put literally the highest quality video we have out there and pump it through right through the live product. I don't get it.
I have something to say about the soccer game, because that was it was a women's soccer game. It was Alex Morgan's Facebook page. You know, she's from the women's soccer team. I am a soccer mom, so I know this. I've been to see these soccer games. You know, they fill half the stadium. I mean, it's just an issue. And yet there are a lot of fans of women's soccer out there. I mean, they're the best team in the world. And so harnessing them in a place like Facebook, I can see where they're going with that, because, you know, it's not the fans of a football, you know, it's not the same as a football team. But there are a lot of dedicated fans. And so it's interesting, and also interesting to me, because I mean, how does that work? Did they pay Alex Morgan to post that on her Facebook page? Do you know how that works?
I do know how that works. Alex Morgan is one of the people that Facebook is paying to do live streams on their pages. So she's part of a pilot that Facebook is in the middle of experimenting with, where they're giving celebrities and athletes and media companies some money in exchange for the promise of doing a certain number of live videos at a time.
That model is just blows my mind. I mean, you're a fan of female sports, Becky. What do you think about that?
Well, I think I see it more from a perspective of the business as a whole. And my philosophy is that the future of broadcasting is narrowcasting, and that doesn't mean low quality narrowcasting, but it has to be cost effective narrowcasting. And one of the ways that you can really reduce cost is by reducing transmission costs and Facebook and platform costs, right? So Facebook has already got all of the infrastructure for transmission and platform. Now what they have to do is they have to aggregate those niche communities so that they can adequately narrowcast and monetize properly to make the production cost worthwhile.
Well, okay, so here's my transition.
Okay.
Because I think this is an important part, at least, of the earnings call, is that Facebook made a proposal for Class C stock. How exactly does that work in keeping Zuckerberg kind of in control? What is that all about, Alex?
Okay, I'm not steeped in the stock law, but from what I understand, this is a way for Zuckerberg to give away his shares, but not lose the voting power that he has now. So he can still control the company the way that he does, but put the money into the Chan Zuckerberg initiative and not wait, you know, let's say 30 years when he retires before he can start using that money for whatever purpose he wants to.
Interesting. Okay. So, and I mean, I know that in this case, basically what it's doing is it takes away shareholder rights to a certain degree because he's kind of locked in there. Does anyone on this panel like know how shareholders normally react to this sort of thing?
I don't think this applies to everyone's stock. This is only for Class B stock, which I believe Mark is the primary holder of. Therefore, it's primarily his stock that will get this four-way split. And therefore, it's sort of like, you know, the voting button is only on one quarter of the pie, to mix my metaphors. and they all get money in dividends and they all hold value. But it's the voting rights that he retains. You know, one of the coolest things that came out of this that I never really thought about was Mark Zuckerberg's annual salary is $1, but they listed his travel and security costs at $5 million. And I thought, okay, travel, I get it. Like maybe, you know, the jets and stuff. But then security costs, I'd never really considered CEO security costs. And while they didn't split them out individually, I looked it up and Forbes had a list of all the security costs for tech CEOs. And the highest for all of them was Jeff Bezos, $1.6 million a year spent to protect Jeff Bezos. Larry Ellison, $1.5 million. I have to disclose the head of Disney, Bob Iger, my boss, $580,000 a year. And Warren Buffett, $385,000 a year. Had you guys ever considered that that was a thing?
No, I hadn't. But I mean, I guess it kind of makes sense because these people wield some pretty intense, incredible power, particularly right now. You know, we keep talking about just kind of the power of technology companies on influencing a whole lot of things. It makes that crossover into the political realm regularly. Makes perfect sense to me. That would happen. I didn't realize that was happening behind the scenes as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, one more question I have to ask. Did they talk about changing the Instagram feed? Because I don't want it to be an algorithm. Did he talk about that at all?
Absolutely.
Did you tell him I didn't want it to be an algorithm?
I'm going to pass the word along.
Okay.
Like there's a movement here. That's
good luck getting past security.
Exactly. That Zuckerberg money is well spent. You know, it's funny because Twitter discussed this also. They said only 2% of people opted out of the algorithmic feed that they've been implementing. And Zuckerberg on the call seemed committed to making that full change, not just an experiment, but the full change to the algorithmic feed in Instagram. Now, you needed to read between the lines a little bit, but he said that people miss 70% of the posts in their Instagram feed. And he said, we see with newsfeed that an algorithm is the best way to sort content. So I think anybody that's praying for this reversal of the algorithmic feed coming to Instagram, you know, can continue to pray, but I don't think it'll make any difference. I think we can expect really soon to see Instagram turn into a fully algorithmic feed.
Well, there you go, Megan. I don't know. Maybe next time you run into Zuckerberg, you can convince
him. Okay, I will.
Just say it.
I'll bail you out, sister.
Alex, it's always a pleasure getting you on the show. Thank you so much for coming on to talk a little bit about Facebook and the earnings and all that. Tell people where they can follow all the work that you're doing online.
Yeah, feel free to hang out with me on Twitter. My handle's below. And Jason, Megan, Becky, thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. We'll have you back soon. Take care, Alex.
See ya.
All right. Paul Smith wrote in. He said, the other day you mentioned that you would like your Apple Watch battery to last longer. Why doesn't Apple find a way to add a battery to the Apple Watch bands? Good question, Paul. They don't, because Apple doesn't want you to do that. There was a product called the Reserve Strap. It was a band that, if you're watching the video version, you can see it, that you could, it had, took advantage of this port in the Apple Watch. And it was, I think it started as a Kickstarter. They've recently said they're not going to ship. They're going to stop shipping them, stop making them, because in a recent Watch OS update, Apple removed functionality from the accessory port. So I think that if you have not updated your Apple Watch, they will still send you one, but it won't work if you update your Apple Watch. And you can also send an email to Apple's hardware evangelism team to stop them from blocking the port. I don't know. I mean, this isn't a really surprising thing that Apple does. Sometimes they did it with, you know, they wouldn't let anyone make a charger for a while that had the charger inside, but they changed back. I'm sure they have ideas. I'm sure they have reasons. But I would like it because my Apple Watch does not last throughout the day.
I would just think of an Apple or a watch strap with batteries built into it would be kind of bulky and unmanageable. That, I mean, the photos, at least, that they were showing, that Kara was showing on the website, didn't look that way. But no. Why? So why would you have the port there with that functionality and then remove the functionality? Did they not know that this was possible to be done?
I don't know. Or? That's a good question. And there must be a reason. But yeah, there you could also...
That's kind of bulky, actually.
That one does. Mind, the I other ones might have just been prototypes. But yeah, that one does look a little bit bulky.
I'm going to get the 80s leather strap backup battery version of that. That'll look cool, you guys. It's kind of chunky for a reason.
Yeah, that looked more like military, like you're wearing a tank on your wrist sort of thing.
I'm sure it might be security. It might be all the reasons, you know. I mean, you can't even change your start screen on your iPhone. I don't know if you knew that.
I mean, I knew that iPhones were more locked down.
They're very locked down, you know, yeah. For our own good.
Yeah. It's what you
we
want,
can't be
Megan.
Trusted with nice things.
Oh, no. You can't be trusted with extra battery in your watch strap. All right, coming up, Becky's going to do a little bit of a deep dive on the energy cost of data storage. But before that... Let's take a minute.
Okay, stop. That is the worst tease I've ever heard because I was nervous that this was going to be a boring topic.
All right, you set it up. Set it up. Better tease.
You were being so nice to me, but I am concerned. I'm going to make it the most interesting, fascinating, sexy, hot, awesome discussion of the energy cost of data storage you have ever heard.
Excellent.
Note to self, let Becky write her own teases from now on.
We'll talk. Whew. But before that, let's thank the sponsor of this episode, and that is Tracker. With advancements in technology, we have all sorts of smart things, smart cars, smartphones, smart homes, you name it, it's probably smart. But losing your possessions makes you feel dumb, less than smart, let's say. Tracker makes losing things a thing of the past. I have a backpack, goes with me many places. Honestly, if I were to lose my backpack, it would be kind of like losing a piece of my life, at least, depending on what's in there. Thankfully, Tracker is lodged into the backpack. And that makes sure that I know when I'm leaving it behind so I can, you know, not do that. Also, it can track my phone. So if I leave my phone somewhere, I hit the button on this. And even if my phone is silenced, which it is, it still rings so I can kind of locate it. It's a coin-sized device. You can see it's very small. You can attach it to your keys, wallets, computers, your bags, your pets, in seconds. You can pair Tracker to your iOS or Android device with its own app. You attach it to anything that you want. It's got an adhesive that you can attach it with, or a key loop, however you choose, or just kind of throw it into a nice tight pocket of something and it'll stay in there for you. It finds its precise location with the tap of that button that I was showing you. It's super easy. If you lose your phone, like I said, you just push the button on the Tracker and your phone rings even when it's on silent. Very cool. The Tracker Bravo is constructed with just a really nice anodized aluminum. It's just a super tight little package. It's thin, it's super durable, and allows you to track your devices. With over 1.5 million devices, Tracker has the largest crowd GPS network in the world. What does that mean? That means that your lost item shows up on a map, the last reported place that it was left anyways. And, if that's miles away, so be it. If that item goes missing, the Tracker app records its last known location. And then when another Tracker user happens to come within 100 feet of that lost item, it will recognize that Tracker, and you'll receive a GPS update of where your item is so you can locate it. Tracker recently introduced Tracker Atlas, which works with your Tracker Bravo or third-party Bluetooth tracker to pinpoint your items on a customizable floor plan of your home. So you can find it under the couch or on the kitchen counter. Save time and energy by simply asking Tracker Atlas where your item is, and you'll instantly get an answer. You don't need to search anymore. So check it out for yourself. Go to thetracker.com. You'll never lose your possessions again if the Tracker is attached to it, that is. Right now, Tracker is having a Mother's Day limited time sale through May 3rd with their best prices ever. Plus, just for our audience, if you enter promo code TNT, you'll get the free color upgrade. That's TheTracker, thetracker.com, promo code TNT. And we thank Tracker for their support. All right, TNT's fan of the day is Jason Adamczyk.
Adamczyk. There we go. I had to phonetically do that because I knew I was going to mess it up, and I did it anyways. Who emailed us at tnt@twit.tv to say, I'm a security guard in Western Australia. I used to work in IT and still provide support services via my own business. To keep the boredom at bay, I throw one headphone on and listen to you guys and other shows on the Twit Network. I usually listen to you at 1.5 times the speed. If you thought Jason talks fast normally, I didn't know that I talked really fast. Anyway, show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup, post it on Instagram, Google Plus, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT and we're going to find it.
You do talk fast.
Mm-hmm. I do when I need to.
Mr. FedEx.
All right.
All right. Sexy, hot cloud storage. Go.
Yeah. That's okay. A tease.
Okay, guys. So, all right. So over the weekend, I was doing some digital spring cleaning, realizing how much hard drive space I had committed to photos, videos, et cetera. And so I was uploading all that stuff to the cloud, feeling so good about myself until I heard this great story on Marketplace yesterday about the energy costs associated with cloud storage and data storage. So the stat that shocked me was it takes 90 billion kilowatt hours a year to store all of our old photos, video, myriad data bits. 90 billion kilowatt hours means nothing to me, but that's the equivalent of 30 large coal-fired power plants. It's a huge amount of energy. Another shocker, traditional data centers consume about 51 million gallons of water per year, enough to fill 77 Olympic-sized swimming pools. So some of the alternatives that are being tried out. So, you know, normally they use fans and air conditioning to pour cold air over servers. Now they're reversing that and they're using these huge heat sinks to draw hot air away. They're even dunking servers in mineral oil, immersion cooling systems for these huge server farms. Then there's green energy. Facebook says their $1 billion data center that they're building in Fort Worth, Texas, will run on 100% wind energy. But this is the thing that made me think we have got to talk about this on TNT, because today a story that could completely revolutionize this issue. Microsoft says it's buying 10,000 molecules of synthetic DNA from San Francisco startup Twist Bioscience. And I'm quoting from the University of Washington newspaper. They ran experiments in conjunction with Microsoft on data storage via DNA. Quote, the team successfully encoded digital data from four image files into the nucleotide sequences of synthetic DNA snippets. They were also able to reverse that process, retrieving the correct sequences from a larger pool of DNA and reconstructing the images without losing a single byte of information. So the idea here is that unlike your CDs, your Blu-ray discs, your tape data storage, DNA can store data for 1,000 to 10,000 years, and 1 millimeter of DNA can store 1 billion gigabytes of data. I had to read this story like 3 or 4 times because it was just sort of mind-boggling, because I think of DNA as being a strand of hair or a cheek swab. I'm completely curious and don't have any answers for you on what physical form this type of storage takes. What is the retrieval process like? You know, when they talk about doing DNA sampling, I think of them like swishing it around in some sort of substance and then growing stuff in a petri dish. Is that searchable? I just am sort of in the wow state of having my mind blown by the future of data storage.
I'm going to blow your mind even further. It's not a billion gigabytes. It's a billion terabytes.
No way.
In a gram.
in a single gram. So... Oh.
And they say they get it from genetic material from research labs.
Right. But it's not.
Wait a minute.
Is that from like my hair salon?
I don't know.
It says, well, this Ars Technica says the company's main customers are research labs that insert custom genetic material into microbes to produce organisms that can perform useful chemical processes.
So
organic material.
Yeah, I think we've just found the replacement for CD-ROM drives right here. DNA drives.
Or we could all just stop taking pictures and enjoy life for the rest of our lives.
No, I'm gonna take so many pictures and have so many to sift through that I never actually look at them. and they don't end up on my wall, but yet I see my life through the viewfinder. That's my idea of a good time. This is what we do, right? Like, yeah. I feel like so many times we're so busy taking our pictures mm-hmm. and filling up our storage, and we have no time to sift through it and actually make sense of it. I don't know what you do with this kind of thing. With billion terabytes, that's just insanity.
But it is a good reminder, though, because it's not physical storage. Like, I tend to think, like, oh, it's free. Like, I should hoard all my cloud storage that I have that everyone's giving me free and just not worry and have every photo in seven places and take, you know, 700 photos every day. But there is a result to all that. I mean, there is a downside.
Sure.
Just something else to feel guilty about.
Exactly. Great. We've given you a lot of those today.
But now we don't have to feel guilty because there's DNA.
See?
And we all have it. DNA.
Yes. Free. The DNA.
Yes. Well, Becky, I'm glad you brought up your hair because then I could say, you know, I could say that you're Becky with the good hair, which I was.
Oh, no, it was me.
Wanting to have a segue into your hair.
Oh, Beyonce's got nothing on me.
I'm just happy that I understood the reference.
Right.
Because it was like Monday mid-afternoon when I heard that Beyonce released an album over the weekend. I was like, wow, I literally. And then I'm like reading, I read an article and it was like, so unless you were living under a rock, blah, blah. I was like, well, that was obviously me because I was totally living under a rock because I had no idea. It's not like I'm a big Beyonce fan, but apparently everybody was talking about it mm-hmm. and I was clueless.
Yeah. You don't have to be part of the Beehive to know, you know, that she released an album. You just
apparently I needed to be part of something that I wasn't. anyways, I'm happy to know the real Becky.
Jason, do you want to explain this for all of our IT professionals who haven't been following?
Becky, we had Winter Mitchell on the show. She explained it all to us. We went to the source, as close to the source as we could ever get.
Okay. And, so Beyonce and Jay-Z's marital problems involving another woman who was referred to as Becky, even though that's clearly not her real name, have now been explained by the epicenter of all things Beyonce, Winter Mitchell. Yeah, I love it.
Exactly.
Okay, good.
Well, Becky, thanks again for coming on, Becky with the good hair, the other Becky with the good hair. What are you working on? What can you tell us? Where can people follow what you're working on?
I have a couple of interesting things. I am hosting the Parkinson's Moving Day in San Francisco this Sunday. So if you want to go for a walk, come on out to the Embarcadero right down by the Ferry Plaza if you're in San Francisco. And this is all to benefit Parkinson's research. And then I am working on Good Morning America's 100 Weddings in 24 Hours live cast tomorrow. So I will be at City Hall accosting people who are trying to get married in peace and asking if we can just film that and broadcast it. So
no big deal.
Maybe I need security tomorrow. Security.
You need security budget, apparently.
I do.
I wish you the very best in that.
thanks, guys. I'll see you next time.
All right.
Thank you, Becky. Always a pleasure. All right, so TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific. This is where I start talking fast, apparently. 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be a part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. You can also leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. You can find us on Twitter. We are at TechNewsTodayTV.
Subscribe to our show in whatever app you listen to podcasts on. You can find all the ways at twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to our technical director and occasional laugher in the background, Kara Cole, and all the folks who help us produce this show every single day. And thanks to you for talking tech with us. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Bye, everyone.